Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we start with playoff content. We have a pair of 2-2 series that we're excited to discuss as they shift to best of threes. And we salute the Oklahoma Thunder and the New York Knicks for not only taking care of business, but doing so in 4-0 fashion. And then we shift to the W side. We finally have regular season action to react to. We talk about some of the things that caught our eyes, the things that we're going to be monitoring moving forward. We got some fun on the way. Stick with us. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce a lot, and I mean a lot, and I mean a lot of basketball to talk about. Excited to do it with you. Let's hoop it up.
Let's hoop it up indeed. We got WNBA regular season action to talk about later in the show. We've got series extending. We've got series ending. We start with the series ender from last night. The Oklahoma City Thunder, a 115-110 victory in game four. They eliminate the Lakers in four games. No Jalen Williams, no problem for the Oklahoma City Thunder. Obviously no Luka Doncic for the entirety of the series for the Los Angeles Lakers. But Steve, I guess, where do you start with this series? Like, it was a weird one for me, at the very least, in light of how Shea was guarding in this series, how close some of these games were, but you still end up 4-0. Lakers with a valiant effort without Luka Doncic, but ultimately didn't have enough. Like, how do you kind of absorb what this series was?
You look at the attempts from the Lakers, and you look at the machine of the Thunder, and you counterbalance and operate within that. Like, I think for me, the first thing I thought of as the series went on, it was a long, long time ago, but I worked in Memphis, and we got to the conference finals, we played the Spurs, and we got swept 4-0. And I will take it to the grave, that was the closest 4-0 sweep you will ever see in your life. Go look it up, the scores. Go look up the first quarter, second quarter, the shifts. The loser of these, you give everything to give yourself a chance against a machine like the Thunder, right? And you find success, but the trouble is trying to sustain it. And it's a feeling you can't really describe because you know exactly what you have to do. You know there's a path to victory, but you have to do it over and over and over again. So I give all the hat tips to the Thunder for their continued excellence and being a machine on both ends of the floor and being built for this time of year. I tip the cap to the Lakers for laying it all out there and putting as many cards as they could on the table and trying to live with the results. Like that back and forth between, hey, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, we are double teaming you, and Shea being like, actually, I'm just going to play out of it. That's fine. It's very tough to digest. So it's a double-edged sword to a degree. And so for me, I respect the Thunder. You know what I mean? I respect that they are a machine. They're a really hard team to beat, and they have built this, and they have depth, and they have versatility, and they have options. And defensively, you're not going to have a good time. They can execute with one big, two bigs. They have multiple defenders who can guard your best perimeter options. You know, we talk about all these talent that teams put together. Hey, we can just guard all of them with multiple people, and then there are big people behind them. Like, it's just not fun. They help. They recover. They rotate. They protect the ball. Offensively, they move the ball. They add pick and roll. They get to drive and kick. They push and transition off those stops. They get on defense. And Shea Gilgeous-Alexander is very, very good at basketball in a way that I just don't think is sticking for some people. He's got the drives. He has the ability to get to his spot. He has the ability to read defenses, make the right plays, and his impact was felt throughout this series because of his ability to, okay, if you're going to double team me because you don't want me to do what I do, I'm going to create these advantages. We're going to play out of that. And then I'm also going to mix in very timely drives, very timely, I got this matchup. Let me get to my step back just to remind you, that's why you're doubling me. And so the thing that Shea does is he makes you uncomfortable with what you're trying to do. That's why I saluted the Lakers for saying, you know what? Actually, no, we're going to double you. And I salute Marcus Smart because Marcus Smart gave everything he could to make life as uncomfortable as possible on Shea. And the Thunder were just like, you know what? Austin Reeves, I don't know, really didn't matter who you're guarding. Shea, you become a screener and do that way. So like, there's just a back and forth there. And I thought Mark Dino had a great point in the post-game press conference about how Shea Gilgeous-Alexander did not fight the game in this series. He found the gaps to attack when they were there. He kept it moving. He kept the advantages, and OKC kept playing out of it. And I think the adaptability of Shea Gilgeous-Alexander flies under the radar for a lot of people. And you got to realize his impact. You know, if you want to leave it at the foul drawing layer, that's fine, but you're missing out on the rest of the meal. You know, there's just a discomfort that he brings to defenses consistently. And that's what makes him so great.
Yeah, like I think to that point, Steve, I'm glad you hit on DeMarcus Smart piece of this. One, still just a very good defender, for one. And you think about the off-ball and on-ball navigation that he had to display in this series to keep Shea uncomfortable, in addition to the waves of double teams that they were hitting him with. And then you just look at some of the quieter offensive possessions where A.J. Mitchell or someone else is bringing the ball up the floor, and you look at the top of your screen, and here's Marcus Smart just shading Shea like a cornerback that's like traveling across the field. And it's just like, we're so used to Steph just being alone in that conversation to where, like, we don't even want you to catch the ball. Forget blitzing you in pick and rolls or showing extra help on your drives. We don't want you to touch the basketball. We don't want you to catch the basketball. And so seeing Shea, who is not that, he has improved as a three-point shooter, but has not been that type of threat, to see him get that kind of off-ball attention in addition to everything else, it speaks to what you were saying. Like, he is very good. He is dangerous. He makes you bend your defense in ways that, you know, we had the James Harden conversation when we got defenders with their arms behind their backs. Again, the Shea coverages that he's seen. I mean, the Steph coverages that he's seen. Like, Shea's getting that to that degree. And that's a high level of respect. And I would hope that that kind of respect permeates throughout the entire NBA community. But, you know, we'll get there when we get there. I also was just impressed with the resolve from the Los Angeles Lakers throughout this series. Like, to commit to that kind of style and, like, final tally, Shea double-teamed on over 22% of his touches, slightly down from the regular season matchups, but still a very high mark overall. That's a lot of energy when you are missing your best guy in Luka Doncic, and to give yourself that amount of a shot, regardless of that, is impressive to me. What trips me out about this, and you already kind of nailed it, the Thunder half-court offense in this series, a 92.9 offensive rating in game one. The final three games, 103.8, well above league average, 125.3, way above league average, 111.4 in game four. And this is with Shea finally having the, yeah, what if I just drop 30 on you game? The fact that the Thunder, for large portions of the series, were just able to play out of the Shea stuff in the way that he's being covered to that degree, they deserve credit for that. They deserve respect for that. Like, we talked about him a little bit on the pod on Friday, but like, A.J. Mitchell has just been incredible for most of this playoff run, but especially in this postseason, in light of the attention that Shea was getting. Like, you needed someone else to be able to take advantage of those tilted defenses, or if you want to start with Shea working off the ball, we need someone else to tilt the defense initially. And he did that. Like, what he did as a driver in this series, Steve, was absolutely nuts. Nearly 1.2 points per possession on drives in game one, 1.6 in game two, 1.6 in game three, 1.4 in game four. The Lakers just could not keep him out of the paint. And the fact that he was able to pair that with playmaking on top of that was super impressive to me. And that's before even getting into what Chet Holmgren was able to do. So, like, I just come away with this, like, with a heightened level of respect for the Lakers, for this being way more competitive than what this series outline overall is, to your earlier point. And the Thunder just kept finding guys to pitch in. A.J. Mitchell was incredible. Chet Holmgren, then you could argue Chet might have just been the best player in the series if you account for what he did on both ends of the floor. And, like, there are so many other things being talked about this series instead of stuff like that. And, like, that kind of bothers me, but I don't want to hang there too long. But just impressive stuff from the Thunder, impressive effort from the Los Angeles Lakers, an impressive effort overall from LeBron James within this contest. Go ahead.
Well, before we get there, you gotta get like Big Jim. You gotta lose internet. It just live a little bit. You know what I mean? You gotta unplug that. I think the thing is, like, Mark Dadnall has always talked about expanding his rotation and finding guys who continue to contribute. And so you saw Isaiah Joe minutes, you saw Jerry McCain minutes, you saw impact throughout the roster, which I think is a big key for the Thunder run. When you're talking about A.J. Mitchell, it is hard when you are trying to deal with a team in a specific way. You're trying to have a game plan to take them and put them in the mud, quote unquote, to bog them down, to get them out of sight of being themselves. And then here comes A.J. Mitchell deciding, I would like to attack the basket at all times. And now, guess what? I'm going to be one pass away from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And so we didn't really budget for you doing that. We knew you were capable of doing that. We were hopeful you wouldn't. And now you've done it to a degree where this is not good for us. We cannot sustain our game plan with you doing this consistently. And I thought that was the big part of, like, game three, Lakers battling working their tails off, trying to score up at halftime. Here comes AJ Mitchell, and he did not stop in that game three. Did not stop. You go to game four, Lakers fighting, battling up at the end of the first quarter. Thunder start the second quarter with an 8-0 run and take the lead back. Like, it's just, there's a discomfort with it. It's tough to deal with. It's hard. Like, we talk about basketball in absolutes these days, data and analytics and everything. We move closer and closer to speaking about it in a black and white manner, but there are shades of gray. There's a subjective nature to this. There are multiple ways to win, and sometimes people have the answer. Sometimes you come up short. That's the game of basketball. Winning is hard. The playoffs are hard. And that brings me to saluting the Lakers. Gave their all. Had the scheme. Mm-hmm. Had the right mindset. These are the shots we can get. This is the defense we can execute. I mean, it's hard. We can't really control tempo if we're not making these type of shots. Okay, but we can defend at a high enough level, and we can poke at you enough to where you're not having a lot of fun. Can we do that over 48 minutes? It's a lot to stack. You know, I like to look at how can a team win a series, and you get if. Yeah, I know that's a lot, but that's the way. That's the path. You don't have the margin for error if you're against a great team. The ability to win in multiple ways is not quite there. That's the tricky part about the Thunder. It's hard. It's difficult. And so that's where you look at a salute to JJ Redick, a salute to the Lakers for the effort, and then a salute to LeBron James. Watching LeBron walk off the court playoff-wise, and that's when my brain started to process the potential of what could happen in the future. And I wasn't really ready for that. I'm still not. You know, I'm 39 right now. I was 16 when he debuted. I was in high school watching him play high school basketball. Those are things that kind of hit like a bunch of bricks. And he laid it all out there, morphed himself to be the best version that he could for this team. When everyone was gone, found a way to rise to the occasion. And it's just, he's one of the greatest players of all time. And it's hard to not salute and tip the cap to him.
Yeah, like this was 23-6-6, nearly 38 minutes per game for 41-year-old LeBron James. Like, that's not how any of that is supposed to work. And the way that he was able to give the Lakers chances with his overall processing of the floor as a playmaker and as a scorer, but just the pressure he was able to put on the Thunder defense at times, working to poke at some size mismatches. But again, you had to the Oklahoma City Thunder. They swarm around and fly around so well that sometimes it's rendered moot. But like, it's kind of wild that LeBron was even here. Or kind of why the Lakers were here. Like, once Luka Doncic went down, Austin Reeves was also out at the same time. Austin Reeves, a late addition to this Lakers rotation, going back to the Houston series. And here's LeBron James ever the metronome. Like, it's, you kind of have to take the step back sometimes. Like, no, do the Lakers, did they want to lose the series? No. Did they want to get swept? No. They won a series and, like, were competitive against a team that should be favorite to win the title at the very least, or at least being, like, the top two. And LeBron James was the head of this at his big age, complimentary. Like, it's kind of nuts that this is what it's turned into. So I wanted to give the hat tip as well. I guess to spin it forward a little bit in relation to LeBron before we move forward, Steve, what do you expect the 2026-27 version of LeBron to look like? And where do you think he's going to be? Is this a return to the Lakers? Is this the go home to Cleveland based on how that series ends? We got some thoughts on that one coming up. Like, any idea of what that could look like?
I have no expectations. I have no idea. It's his decision. He's earned that right. And I don't know. Whatever path he wants to go on is going to be his choice. And so what have you thought about it? Because I'm more in just a place where, like, I don't remember the last time I didn't think about LeBron not playing in the NBA. And thinking about that was odd. So
no,
if this is it, this is it. If wherever he goes, he's still LeBron.
Yeah, that's fair. I think for me, if I had to power rank what I think happens heading into the offseason, I think number one on the list is a return to the Lakers. 1 year deal, 1+1, whatever the financials end up looking like. I think it's return to the Lakers, one. I think it is some sort of the Cleveland Cavaliers, two. Like, I think if he's not a Laker uniform and he's playing next year, it's probably going home for the swan song. And so I don't know if that's LeBron saying, hey, I've made X amount of money, I can just take mid-level exception, minimum, whatever is open for Cleveland and go. Or if this is like, can we work out some sort of sign and trade? Jared Allen, can you go to the Los Angeles Lakers because they want a big, you get LeBron, whatever. Number three on the list is retiring. I don't think he's going to go out on a sweep with no kind of you know, he's kind of talked about not wanting a full like retirement tour, et cetera. It's fine. He's LeBron James. And I say this complimentary. Like, he's meant too much to the league to not get a year of that. But like, retirement's probably number three for me. And then number four, if he does go elsewhere and it's not Cleveland, I had some brief ideas on like some fits that would make some sense, whether it's sign and trade or elsewhere. Can I spin those for you before we move to the next segment?
Yeah.
Okay. So if it is not.
What am I going to do? Say no?
I mean, it's a no. Like that, I did give you that option. I just let it had to go to Cavs, Pistons. But Miami, as they have the salary, he has the history there. And they're going to be in the running for Giannis. If they do not get Giannis or any other star that pops up open, surely at least a phone call is made, even if it's a short one. Golden State, because I feel like him and Steph have just been kind of half talking around, hey, it'd be really cool to get to play with this guy at some point. And I don't think Steph's going anywhere. So I don't know if that's a Jimmy Butler trade or. And then two more wild cards for you, Steve. The Detroit Pistons and the San Antonio Spurs. How would you feel about LeBron in either one of those spots?
I feel like it's time to talk about the Detroit Pistons and the Cleveland Cavaliers.
There we go. We have gotten to the segue. Let's move to Cleveland, Detroit. As we talked about the guys, like, hey, Detroit has established some things on both ends of the floor. Cleveland, you have to turn some counters. Your guards have to play better. But Detroit, all you did was take care of home court. Let's see what these next two games look like. And sure enough, Steve, 116-109 victory in game three for the Cleveland Cavaliers. A 112-103 victory in game four. We have a 2-2 series heading into a pivotal game five later in the week. So I will toss this to you, Steve. What kind of stood out to you across these two games, and what are some of your pressing questions as we head into this best of three now between these two teams?
Well, I mean, I think the back and forth of this series has been tremendous playoff basketball, and I think the contrast between the two teams has been excellent as far as what Detroit was able to do when they were at home, what Cleveland was able to do at when they were at home, and both teams have shown their formula, they've shown their hand, and now it's the best out of three. That's what you want out of a series. Mm-hmm. In the Toronto series, we saw why Cleveland put James Harden and Donovan Mitchell together in games one and two. In this series, we saw why Cleveland put James Harden and Donovan Mitchell together in games three and four. Now, it's on James Harden and Donovan Mitchell to maintain this kind of level of aggression. It's on Detroit to take that off the table. But my goodness, when those two have it going, it's really tough to deal with. And I think a lot of times when we're talking about players like James Harden, we're talking about players like Donovan Mitchell, we look at them and I don't know if we understand the responsibility to be the engine of an offense and how, you know, stripping away what they've done statistically and understanding the assignment as far as what they have to do for their team, what they have to contribute, and how defenses are working and playing to try and take them away. And I like, you got to be able to separate that at some point. Think about how you felt about Cleveland post game two, and how do you feel about Cleveland post game four? They went from purposeless to purposeful. They went from hopeful to intentional. And I think the aggression from James Harden was really important in multiple ways. I think you saw him be able to attack Detroit's bigs a little bit more in drop coverage. Cleveland in that game four felt like rinse and repeat. We are going to attack a matchup. Duncan Robinson, Tobias Harris, would you like to come here? We're going to poke at this. We're going to drive, and we're going to poke at your rotations, get you to overhelp on a paint touch, and we're going to spray out of it. And so I think Cleveland being more decisive offensively was huge. They felt more comfortable than they did in the first two games. They put Jalen Duren in actions. They used drives to get Detroit to just help, and they had their flow back, which I thought was huge. And I think the other side of it is the Cavs were way more active and physical on defense. And so upping the activity against Cade Cunningham and trapping him, and pulling their weak side in and saying, you know what, Asar Thompson, the impact that you had in the first two games is not going to be the same. We're just going to help off of you, and you might flow into a different action, but we're taking away Cade. They're not unlocking the roles for Duren, and we're going to live with the results. It's going to be really interesting. Like, we have, if you're Cleveland, an aggressive Jared Allen, look at the seal and hit if he gets a switch, or even if he doesn't. If he rolls, he rolls hard. Evan Mobley, I thought, was fantastic defensively in that game four. He was everywhere, and him being more aggressive and impactful. And so I think that's the dynamic. Cleveland was searching for a lot of things in that game two. If you go back to it, they've now found it in game three and game four. So, I mean, if you're like the avalanche that Cleveland had to start that second half, like, think about this game. Think about that game four we watched, right? Detroit's defense was not at the level it needed to be. And Caris LeVert and Tobias Harris said, don't worry about it. And they were able to lean into enough of their defense to have the lead. And then Cleveland was able to kind of just poke at them again. And so, like, if James Harden's going to be able to attack matchups, if Detroit's going to overhelp, like, that's it for me to a degree, right? Like, Cleveland literally said, we're attacking your matches, we're poking at your help. It does not matter. This is a challenge they face against Orlando. But this is a Cleveland team that is much more equipped to make you pay once they get you in rotation. And so, I think for Detroit, there's several things they got to address. But I'll pass the ball back to you.
Okay. I think on the Cleveland front, even hammering home on the game four in particular, I have it in my notes, Steve, as I was watching this game. Donovan Mitchell, I think, taking free throws at the 4:19 mark of the second quarter. It's like, hey, Donovan Mitchell has finally scored a point. To go from that late in the second quarter to what the quarter was for Donovan Mitchell and what the second half was for Donovan Mitchell overall was incredible to me. As I was very much like looking through the first two games, we talked about it on Friday. I was like, hey, as much as Detroit is doing good things, we talked about it, you do just kind of need your guards to play better. And for me, I needed to see a better version of Donovan Mitchell and what the reminiscent of the version that we saw through the first two games of that Toronto series, again, said that on the pod, than what we had been getting in that series. And in the first half of that game, it's like, hey, this is a 1-of-6 or 1-of-7 start, like still playing relatively decisively. So that portion was like, hey, this needs to be better. And as we were watching the game, as we have the Dark Spot Discord, I hopped in there. And I was like, I asked during that second quarter, it's like a question that's going to sound like hate, but it's a generous question. I was like, how much better has Donovan been than Max Drew so far through this series? And immediately got, hey, let's calm down a little bit. But like, I was impressed with the timely shot making, defensive plays Max Drew's making, but it's also like, Donovan, I haven't loved the process, the shot making hasn't been there. That second half happened. I was like, all right, yeah, this is why Donovan Mitchell gets the big bucks. This is what the Cleveland Cavaliers were promised when they traded for Donovan Mitchell. The shot, the drive for him, the post shooting for him. I was like, hey, man, finally, it didn't need to be 43 points to be clear. But it's just like this consistent amount of pressure that you put on Detroit's defense was insane to me. Tied an NBA playoff record for most points in a single half. Like it's.
We couldn't find you in that second half, big dog.
I literally commented. I was back in there. I sure did. The thumbs up is crazy. The receipts are there. But anyway, in all seriousness, to go from James Harden slamming the door the way that he did in game three into the second half for Donovan Mitchell in game four, that's what you want more of if you're the Cleveland Cavaliers. And I think to dinging Detroit's defense portion of the program, Duncan Robinson has not had a good time over the course of these last two games. But again, he's not the only one that Cleveland has looked to poke at. You already touched on that portion. Cleveland finding answers in pick and roll is something that you touched on, I think, towards the end of the game. When you talk about game two in particular, like, hey, the second half, they were able to find some things. You saw that more consistently throughout these first two games. I, for one, was super intrigued by the amount of success Cleveland had with some of the rescreens they were getting into and some of the late angle flips as they were also clearing space with some cuts and some subtle relocations. That paired with Harden plus Mitchell just acting a little bit quicker in pick and roll, they were able to get back to some of these pocket passes to Jared Mobley so he can get downhill, to Evan Mobley downhill. I do wonder how much Detroit wants to react to that portion of the program, because they did start mixing in, you know, second half of game three in particular. Like, let's pre-rotate to these roles even more aggressively, and we're just going to dare these other guys to knock down shots if necessary. Can they afford or ramp it up to that degree? I'm curious to see what that's going to look like over the next two or three games. We'll see. And then just quickly to the Detroit side, they cannot afford to turn the ball over the way that they did in Cleveland across game three and game four. Like, they are a team that is predicated on setting up their own defense and making life difficult and being able to run in a transition themselves. If they are now having players get poked at defensively, you mentioned Duncan Robinson, you mentioned Tobias Harris and some others. If Cleveland's making life there, then you get to the other end and we're putting two on the ball against Cade Cunningham. Tobias Harris is doing everything he can, but he finally had a four shooting performance in game four. You kind of need someone else. The Danis Jenkins that we got in games one and two was not the Danis Jenkins that we got in games three and four. And I'm still just kind of waiting on Jalen Duren to give us some leniency offensively in this postseason. He has the talent to do so. We've seen through pockets of these last two games to where short roll, I put the ball on the floor, shoulder into chest, I move you, I dunk on you. or pick and roll, here's a switch or just a drop. I can capture my defender, seal, put you underneath the basket. There have been seeds of that throughout this series and throughout this postseason. He hasn't been able to put it together consistently enough to have the impact that we saw over the course of the regular season, and especially like the last month of the regular season. And the Pistons just kind of need him to be better. Like, I'm echoing the message that I had Mitchell and James Harden heading into games three and game four. You just kind of need a better slash more consistent version of Jalen Duren. Like, I appreciated what Isaiah Stewart and Paul Reed in particular they put together, but like, you need your number two, ideally, to be your number two.
Nekai is playing the Detroit Pistons hits once again, all the time. Nekai's a defense first team. He's going to, but ching. I think for Detroit, once again, you got to get your defense in order. That's the number one thing. Your defense has to be way more solid, way more consistent. And so you have to be able to have that foundation to contain dribble penetration, to rotate the way that you want to rotate. The challenges are not different for Detroit. This is a lot of what Orlando presented, but Cleveland has a lot more as far as being able to just kind of hammer this home. And so dribble penetration, if you are over-helping and no one's rotating behind you, we saw in the Orlando series when Detroit was bad rotating on the weak side, they got dinged. Now, Orlando missed a lot of shots, but there were open looks. Cleveland's not going to give you. You don't have the same margin for error against Cleveland. So, okay, let's find a way. Be cleaner. Are you going to go show and recover with Duncan Robinson, Tobias Harris? Are you going to be able to have different kinds of help? Are you going to be able to trust the defense can keep the ball in front? Are you going to stay at home more? Like, how do you kind of contain that to where Cleveland doesn't have the rhythm of, well, we can drive, force you to help. We can go pick and roll and force you to help. We can just play out of your help. Like, you have to kind of contain that to a different degree. I think you need Jalen Duren to play at a higher level, but you got to understand, like, he's in his head. He has to stop thinking about basketball, and he has to play basketball. That's the biggest thing he has to do in these playoffs. We saw stretches in that second quarter of that game four where he was able to get a deep seal and get a touch. He was able to drive and finish. He's just got to trust the work that he's put in. He's got to get out of his head and stop being his own harshest critic. Self-doubt will always put you in a place of having a hard time. He's got to believe in what he's done. He's got to go out there and play. Just play. If you lose, you lose. But go out there and play with joy and play with effort. You need Kay Cunningham to take care of the ball, but we remember, go back to the Orlando series. The first quarters were full of Detroit turning the ball over despite having good offensive process. So, yeah, they can't turn it over. What happens is Kay Cunningham is now getting trapped more, especially with Cleveland's bigs. Jared Allen, Evan Mobley, we're going to hit. Okay, can you flip that back on Cleveland? Can that open Jalen Duren as a roller? We saw Cleveland rotate over, pull over the weak side, and kind of say Detroit play out of it. But can you poke at that a little bit? Can you go empty side? Can you make that something that's uncomfortable? Because I thought it was a very dynamic deal where you didn't necessarily hammer Cleveland for being able to put two on the ball against Cade. There were turnovers. But you did have Cade attacking matchups still. And you had Tobias Harris attacking drop because he's still getting dropped. So if Cade's able to mix in, I can win these matchups. If they can solve the two on the ball portion, not even necessarily unlocking Jalen Duren, but we can just kind of play out of this. Okay, does that put Cleveland on their back heel defensively and make them a little bit more comfortable to a degree? You know, I think you need Asar Thompson to stay out of foul trouble and get back to being effective off ball, you know? And so find the rhythm, find the flow, have the confidence, continue to play. Both teams have shown what they want to do. And I think if you're Detroit, you can't live in a world where Cade is getting trapped and you are not getting anything out of it. So you got to fix that. You got to get your defense back in order. And that's what you have to do. If you're Cleveland, we want to live here. We want to have our offense feeling this comfortable. We want to have James Harden and Donovan Mitchell this aggressive. We want our defense to set up to where we know what we're going to do. It's on Detroit to flip that. It's on Cleveland to keep there. Like, that's the back and forth. This is playoff basketball. This is what we do.
You know what? On that note, well done, Steve. We're going to take a break from there. And when we return, we salute the New York Knicks, and then we talk about the other 2-2 series that is happening, because boy, am I fascinated by what that best three is going to look like. Stick with us. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, it's time to quickly salute the New York Knicks, who just get to wait for a little bit for the Eastern Conference Finals opponent. Since the last time we've a 108-94 victory over the Philadelphia 76ers. And then game four happened. a 144 to 114 win for the New York Knicks that really wasn't that close in the throes of it. The first half got incredibly nasty, incredibly quickly, in which we were joking about this a little bit earlier. But like watching the first Deuce McBride three in that game four and hearing the loud deuce while the ball's in the air. And I'm just like, wait a minute, that is not what it is supposed to sound like in there. What is this? And I even tweeted it. I was like, hey, this does not sound like a Knicks road game, but just ends up being a huge win for them. They ultimately sweep the series. Steve, that's just general takeaways from this series for the New York Knicks, or just what kind of stood out to you in this one?
I mean, I think the biggest thing for me is the Knicks answered a lot of questions. They had a great response, and this felt like a team on a mission. And so I think they learned the lessons from the Hawks series to a degree as far as what we need to do. And like, let's play through Karl-Anthony Towns. I think he's been so impactful in these playoffs as far as let's have some off-ball action. Let's have some movement. So we're not just doing pick and roll with Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns. We could sprinkle that in, but we now have a blend as far as they threw Cat, being able to attack, having Jalen Brunson who can keep pressure on Philadelphia. And Philly never really had that handle on how they wanted to guard Jalen Brunson in pick and roll. I thought that was important, especially when you talk about games two, games three. Are we up? Are we dropping? You know what I mean? Are we showing help from our wings? The Knicks were able to play out of that. They were able to get movement. They were able to have a defense that was solid and felt good about what they were doing. I think putting it all together was so key because Philadelphia was able to find some things. They had some pace. They had some tempo. They had Joel Embiid getting doubled. They had Tyrese Maxey drawing attention. The problem is the Knicks, Karl-Anthony Towns, did his job defensively in the series. Jalen Brunson did his job defensively in the series. So you didn't necessarily get to, we are able to hit all of these pressure points. And so the Knicks were able to respond offensively, and I thought they just had a really clean process. And you saw that the confidence they displayed in that game four. Like, the elimination Knicks, I guess, have decided we're just going to, like, you're going one-on-one with the Undertaker, and that's just it. It's over for you. Like, they just decide it's over. It's done. Like, I know elimination games are weird, but, like, Deuce McBride hits, what, three or four threes in the first 4 minutes? And it's like, well, you gotta deal with it. I want to ask a Knick fan, how do you feel about Deuce McBride after this series versus how you felt when he was guarding CJ McCollum in the Atlanta series? I want to do that, but I won't do that right now. But, I mean, I just tip the cap to the Knicks. I mean, the Sixers gave their best effort, but the Knicks did not give them the automatics that the Celtics did to a degree. And the Knicks had a better flow than the Celtics had. And they had stronger pressure points as far as you don't really feel comfortable with how you're guarding Jalen Brunson. You tried switch, you tried drop, you tried two on the ball, you tried show and recovery, you tried a lot of things. And we're not necessarily relying on him and that action to be the only thing we're executing. And so I tip the cap to New York, who has met their playoff potential. Like, all year long, through the highs, through the lows, this is a team that can raise their ceiling in the playoffs. Are there certain things they have to do? Absolutely. They've done those through two series. And so they're now four games away from getting a chance to compete for a championship, and they've earned that opportunity.
Yeah, they deserve the love there. Like, I think round one for me felt like a Karl-Anthony Towns / OG Anunoby series for what they were able to do on both Finn Cat as a hub and what he was able to open up, the matchup problems that he caused the Hawks, and OG defended his tail off and just knocked down every shot imaginable, especially at the end of the clock. Round two very much felt like a Jalen Brunson series for me. Not that Karl-Anthony Towns wasn't good, not that OG Anunoby wasn't very good before going down. Obviously, his health is going a little bit heading into whoever they face in the Eastern Conference Finals. I would imagine that he should be okay, or at least you hope he's going to be okay for the start of that series whenever it starts. But you nailed it very early on, Steve, as you were talking about the series. The Sixers just could not find a consistent answer for what they wanted to do against Jalen Brunson, independent of what the actual results were. There was a lack of comfort that they had with deep drop crap. He's just getting that stuff. Two on the ball crap. He's playing out of it still. Switching, oh no, he's poking at matchups. And holistically, when you have that kind of Brunson problem with, you don't even know if he's initiating to start off a possession, because they've done such a good job and they've been so intentional about letting Karl-Anthony Towns run some of this from the high post. We can't get a beat on him off the ball either. Sometimes he's just receiving a screen to run into a catch, and then he's posing the same problems. Other times it is ball to Karl-Anthony Towns. I'm going to cut through to one of the corners. I'm going to screen for someone. You decide if you want to switch or not. And then you're playing out of that. He was such, not only was Jalen Brunson just incredibly good in this series, he was such a moving target that it made it so much more difficult for the Sixers to consistently put him and thus the New York Knicks half-court offense in a box. And if the Knicks can maintain that kind of balance, it is going to be incredibly tough for whoever wins out of Detroit and Cleveland to bottle that up, because they could just move so many of their pieces around. And then being able to find enough defensively in this series was also impressive on top of that. So one, the quick hat, but just an incredible series for the New York Knicks. To the Sixers portion of the program before we move to the other 2-2 series, my bigger picture question that I have for them is how they absorb this series, one, in this playoff run, and how they want to move forward based on this. Because I think we saw in pockets of this postseason, when we have everyone and Tyrese Maxey is able to lead the dance as a driver and mix in these pull-ups and make good playmaking decisions, BJ Edgecombe certainly isn't afraid of the moment. We know we have in him, Joel Embiid can just be an instant pressure point for us. Paul George throughout this postseason run, incredible defensively on and off the ball. But then also, we can just use Tyrese Maxey as a cross screener, let Paul George set up shot 18 feet from the basket, and he can just sprinkle in jumpers over your head or just knock down threes and pull-ups against drop. We saw those early second quarter runs where he's just spearheading the second unit, and I can just take this for a time. There are 4-4 here that is very intriguing to me if they are healthy. But the if they are healthy portion looms so large over this group, and it kind of makes me wonder, did they see enough to just tweak around those four? Or do you pivot to a younger, this is Maxey plus VJ, let's build something sustainable there? Like, I'm really curious to see how they absorb that.
They're in a tricky spot if you look at the last 2 years, because they wanted to go in one specific direction and the year didn't go great health wise. And also it was like, hey, you can't really do that. You can't go small ball. That's not going to work. It's not going to be what you need it to be. So this year, while they nurse Joel Embiid and try to navigate him through the season, okay, Tyrese Maxey, let's max you out. BJ Ashcombe, you're the person we need, and we're going to find things to have pace and tempo while Joel Embiid's not here. And when he comes back, that's going to elevate us. And navigating through that puts you in a trickier spot than just saying, hey, let's throw Joel Embiid over the top rope and let's move on. Because there were spots where this team did have a blend of we have stuff where Joel Embiid is able to make us better, and you have to deal with him, and we have Tyrese Maxey and BJ going, and we can run stuff with our other guys, and you have to deal with that. So how do you pivot, or how do you digest that dynamic? Because they got to the second round for a reason. Like, I understand the disappointment, but they beat the Celtics for a reason because of all the work they put in to have this combination. Was it enough to get to the Knicks? It was not. But do you find yourself saying, can we tweak this one last time and swing the bat and hope that Joel Embiid is a lot healthier and we maximize this? Or do you pivot and now have to rebuild again to a degree? Because you're not going to have that hub of Embiid. Like, you're gonna have Maxey and Edgecombe. They're going to put pressure on teams, but you're not going to have that final boss degree to where you have to deal with all of this together. So I don't know. I don't know what the final answer is going to be for them, but salute to them.
I think that's fair. And like, there is the part one, like, should they pivot, that you could have your opinion on. And let's say your answer is yes, they should. We don't think they're going to be able to beat New York next year or healthier ball, whatever your opinion is. Let's say the answer is yes. The second part of the question is, how do they do that? Because you now have the Joel Embiid extension, I think, kicking in. That's 3 years, nearly $200 million. If you decide, yes, this is the answer, what does that even look like? Becomes the bigger question from there, because like, I don't think at this stage, as good as Joel Embiid is when he is healthy, and we saw that during the regular season from that like mid-December stretch onward, like, holy crap, he can still post up, face you up, get to the free throw line, play make better against double teams, anchor your defense, even though we're still monitoring how often he's jumping. We made that joke, but you know, he can still very much perform at a top 10 level when healthy. But there are the health concerns, and now it's the contract. So it's like, am I getting like 2 or 3 blue chip prospects for Joel Embiid? Like, probably not. And so like, even threading the needle there becomes incredibly difficult. Like, I don't think it's directly analogous to like the Suns trading Kevin Durant, but it's like a similar, like, the Suns didn't get like an A+ trade package for KD, and they were still able to kind of reconfigure things and ultimately made the playoffs. So like, it is possible to like not get an A+ return, or your theoretical A+ return, and still fund these things out. But that's still a needle to thread. And so, like, if I had to guess, I think they try to win around the margins again and they push this into next season. And then maybe we're having the same conversation next year, depending on how the playoffs go for them. I don't know if they can pivot right now. I think they can't, they're kind of boxed in. There's an argument to just win anyway, but I think because of the extension and things, like, there's going to be a prove it era to this that I think pushes this decision to next year anyway. So I think that's where I'm largely at. Let's now move to the other Eastern Conference series, Steve.
The what?
Or let me start it over. Let's move to the other 2-2 series that we have. In the Western Conference, we got Spurs, we got Wolves. We are tied at 2 games apiece. Game 5 happening later tonight. But we've had some fascinating basketball games between these two. Big game 3 win for the Spurs. You get the game 4 win for the Minnesota Timberwolves, which included early in the second quarter. We get a bit of a tie-up. Victor Wembanyama, Jaden McDaniels has an arm. Julius Randle trying to box out a little bit. He's got a little bit of the shin. We get the elbow from Wemby. He is ejected from the game. The Wolves ultimately win. There's no further fine or suspension, so we are just going to see Wemby in game 5. Same general question for you, Steve. Like, what kind of pop for you through these last 2 games that we've seen, and what are some of the pressing questions that you have moving forward in what is now a best of 3 between these two teams?
Wemby said, je ne sais pas, and he said, how you know? I think what a series this has been, and the dynamics are on display, and it's curious to see at which lands going forward. I think we see Minnesota's path to victory. We see San Antonio's path to victory. Who's going to get it done? And so the timing is not great to record a podcast sometimes for this series, but Anthony Edwards' ability to hunt shots and get healthier as the series goes on. Minnesota's ability to drive and get in the paint. How key is that? Minnesota's defense being able to hold up. The Spurs guards being able to get downhill and flow and attack the Wolves offense. And Wemby being able to make the Spurs defense consistently cause problems. Like, these are things that we've seen have an impact for both sides. We've seen both teams trying to emphasize a level of drive and kick, working to get the defense to help, spray it back out and get another attack. But with Victor Wembanyama on the court, it's not as guaranteed that you're going to get the same level of paint touch. And so is it on Anthony Edwards to be able to make the shots against drop defense? And you counter with how the Spurs have worked to double him randomly and say, you cross half court, we're doubling you. You saw Minnesota work to counter that in that last game, game 4, as far as, okay, get off of it. Let's get to pass and cut. Let's try and attack. Let's get you a handoff. Let's get to the second action and let's work to rotate the Spurs defense. So who can take what off the table? I think it's huge. Can you establish Naz Reid and Julius Randle? When you do, you have success. When you don't, it's not as great. If you're the Spurs, our defense is going to take us to a certain level, going to bring us to the dance, have us playing a high enough level. Can our guards consistently poke at Minnesota? Can we feel comfort offensively? Can Wemby make these type of plays? Like, this is the dynamic. Spurs have to establish their guards and defend. Minnesota has defended enough of a level, and Anthony Edwards has enough make enough plays. Jamie Nails is very important. IO is important. But, like, it's going to be on Ant to swing the bat in the right way, and it's going to be on the Spurs to defend enough and score on the other end. That's, to me, it feels like we're in the battleground portion of this series.
No, I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, what I have in my notes, like, my big picture thought that I want to toss towards you was, do the Spurs have a non-Wemby problem in this series? And I think that was naturally loud in game 4, as the Spurs just quite literally did not have Victor Wembanyama available for an entire half plus of basketball. But just in general, we've been talking about heading into the series and through the early portion of the series, the Wolves offense in terms of their process looks a lot different when Wemby's on the floor compared to when he is not there. And then you see in the game 4 where the Wolves attacked in a different way, spearheaded by what Anthony Edwards was able to put together. But then you get to the end of that game and it's, hey, what if we run out a lineup of Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels, Naz Reid, Julius Randle, and Rudy Gobert together, and we just have this level of collective size. And then you look on the other side, and it is Fox, it's Harper, we had Castle, we had Vassell, and I think Luke Kornet before they went smaller with Julian Champagne. And so it's just like, hey, man, there's a pretty big size difference here that Wemby would help with defensively to help clean some of this stuff up. And also, like, you could complicate some of the ways that Minnesota wants to match up if he's there. It's like, that's kind of interesting. And I was kind of looking at some of the on-off stuff for Wemby throughout this postseason run and throughout this series. First half, 1 to 2 minutes with Wemby off the floor. Obviously looked a little bit different in games 3 and 4 compared to the first 2 games of the series. We're filtering for that. But, like, to your battleground portion, Steve, like, this series is about their stars. I think it is about how much Wemby is able to dictate defensively. And you know, on the other side of that, like what decision making Anthony Edwards, how he's able to tag and like the doubles he's seeing, the drop that he's seeing at different times, things like that. But then you flip to the other side. It's like, okay, what does the Wimby offense look like in this series? How are the Wolves working to take him away? So to the Wimby offense portion, in terms of like where they're getting Wimby's touches and ultimately where he's shooting from, you look at his average shot distance per game. It was about 16 feet in game one, hovering around 16 feet in game two, 12 and a half feet in game three, and then back up to 15 feet in game four before he was ultimately ejected. And again, it was a mix of Wimby receiving off-ball screens. They mixed in some pick and rolls for him. It was like a lot of perimeter-based attacks against Rudy Gobert. Early in that game four as well. So again, just in general, how are they mixed again, where he's touching it and like, what is he looking to do? I think it's going to loom large as we get into this best of three. And in relation to getting Wimby touches in different areas, looking at the pick and roll stuff with how they're matching up, he's getting Rudy Gobert early. Minnesota obviously downsizing with some Julius Randle at the five and some of those smaller lineups. Where he's screening from is interesting to me, looking at these last two games. With some of the lower stuff, seven picks, 1.6 points from those trips. Thoughts from Stephon Castle to get Wimby some touches, particularly early in that game four. 25 to 29 feet, 10 picks, 1.2 points per possession. And then you sprinkle in the super high stuff, which lower efficiency, but I kind of like them mixing those in. One thing that I've appreciated from Wimby is as Minnesota is trying to decide, okay, are we going with a drop when they're running these this high? Are we going with an under against De'Aaron Fox? So there's those two. Wimby has done such a good job of getting out of there and then capturing whoever his defender is that and it turning it into kind of like a seal. And then just kind of getting those deep middle catches from there. Like, I want to see more of those sprinkled in. So, again, lower efficiency, but I'm curious to see, like, where they land at in terms of how they want to use Wimby in pick and roll moving forward. So, want to sprinkle that in. We are going to take a break from here. And when we return, Steve, we've got regular season WNBA action to react to. Excited to talk about what we've both seen. Stay tuned. We're going to have some fun. And we are back with this episode of The Dunker Spot. Steve, it is time to shift to the WNBA. We finally have regular season games to. Everyone has played at least once. A few teams have already played twice. We got some early season back-to-backs for a couple of teams that both head coaches were not very pleased about. But we'll get there. Just in general, Steve, like, how excited are you that we are finally here and we finally get to discuss this stuff?
Very. I mean, one, I'm glad they're playing. Two, it's a really fun start to the season. And I think it's going to be a really fun year in the W, a very competitive league. And I know it's short sample theater because, you know, we haven't seen a ton of games, but I can't wait to see how these teams develop and how these teams grow throughout the year. Like, it's not changing how competitive and tough it is to win in this league. But what's interesting is how the middle portion of the league gets established, what the difference is between teams as the season goes on. It feels like each team kind of presents a different type of challenge. And you can poke at one team, another may poke at you. You know, shout out to the Mercury for that back-to-back to where they look like one thing on one night, they look different on the other. And so I can't wait to see how it develops, especially as more teams get tape on each other. And so I think it's just who can execute, who can find the right rhythm, who's going to be able to bring their defense to a high enough level, who's going to attack offensively. But I thought overall, you felt identities from each team that you watched throughout this opening weekend. And that's the real fun part as this season develops.
I'm glad you said that. I have one question for you before we get into like specific teams and things. As you know, we had kind of like the truncated training camp just overall offseason because of the CBA negotiations and things. And I know you normally take a, let's see what they look like in game one, see what they look like in game two and game 10, see how you're tracking the progress. Do you anticipate giving teams more grace this year in light of what the training camp schedule was and things like that? Or is it still kind of a similar process to how you're evaluating how good or not good a team may be?
I think it's more grace for me with how quickly these teams came together with some of the pieces they added. I think kind of what I alluded to in the preview is there's teams that have a base of continuity. Okay, are you establishing that? Are you establishing what you were, first of all, and are you building on that? Like, I think, like, there's grace to be given to them to, hey, you do have to get back to this to a degree, and you also have to evolve. So what does that look like? And there are teams that have come together recently, and now, okay, what do you look like? What's your attempt? What are you trying to do on both ends of the floor? How does that grow? And so for me, especially with, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, this how you say points of emphasis trial we have going on. Mm-hmm. It can get a little muddy to evaluate teams because the flow is being disrupted. And I would like y'all to stop doing that. And I'm not even ref guy. That's not even my thing. But stop. Stop it. Okay. But so it's just kind of gaining the understanding the rhythm of what these teams are trying to do, what they're trying to execute, and how they grow. Like, I think that's the important portion, right? How are these teams growing throughout this opening week, the second week, the third week?
Okay. Well, speaking of a team that has a lot of experience of growing throughout a season and turning things around, let's start with the Las Vegas Aces. Last year's champions, as we know, under 500 at a point. They lose by 53 to the Lynx. They win the rest of the regular season and ultimately win a championship. I was in Vegas for the ring ceremony slash their opener against the Phoenix Mercury. Great crowd. Ring ceremony was dope. A ring inside of a ring is just kind of insane, complimentary. So I want to give the quick salute there. But then they faced the Phoenix Mercury. And the Mercury with a 99-66 victory over the Las Vegas Aces that felt worse at parts of that season, at parts of that game. And then they bounce back the very next day. They played the new look Los Angeles Sparks, and it's a 105-78 victory. So very much a tale of two games, particularly for the Aces defense, which that was the question mark that I had for them heading into the year. We did our preview content. Was, hey, are they able to establish their defense earlier? Just in general, what do they land on? And so watching this Aces group, my eyes naturally were on the defense. Like, what are these switches going to look like? What is the transition defense and the transition matching up going to look like? And you saw in that Mercury game, it was not ideal. The Mercury to poke at the space that the Aces were giving during some of their switches. If you did have an Alyssa Smith or an Asia Wilson in drop, or if you had either one of them up at the level, the Mercury were able to play out of that. Yvonne Nogic just knocked down all sorts of threes, catch and shoot, pull up threes, transition threes. It just did not matter. And then you had the Mercury sprinkling and cuts on top of that. It's like, well, this is what the first half of the Aces season looked like last year. And that is obviously not where they want to be. And that's something that Becky Hammon has talked about through preseason and even after that game. Hey, we spend an hour and a half, 2 hours of every practice talking about defense. I felt good about what we were putting together in practice. I'm not sure why it looked like this against the Phoenix Mercury. And then you get to the Sparks game where the intensity was a lot better. The pickup points felt better. The switches were cleaner. The overall physicality was better. And you saw ports, particularly in that first half and in that third quarter, where it didn't feel like the Sparks knew where they wanted to get to. It's like, well, if the Aces can bottle that and then play out of their transition offense, and you get these quick hitters to Melissa Smith ahead, you get Asia Wilson streaking down the middle of the floor, you get Jackie Young flowing into pull-ups and mixing in drives, you get Chelsea Gray knocking down catch-and-shoot threes. Like, oh, this is what the Aces can look like. In addition to Kennedy Carter coming off the bench and just scoring and scoring and scoring and scoring. And so it's just interesting that that is the dichotomy that we got from the Las Vegas Aces. It was a very loud, when we defend, we can be the team that we want to be. When we do not, it can be very bad. Historically so, in terms of ring ceremony or season openers for a champion, as we saw against the Phoenix Mercury. So that's kind of where I started with the Las Vegas Aces.
Yeah. We're starting the Nekiah Steve dynamic on the Aces a little bit earlier than we usually do, but I think it's interesting because I think you were very much like, I don't know what they're going to do defensively watching that Phoenix game, and I understand, but I think it had to be cleaner in that game, but you saw the vision. Some of the switches got odd against the Mercury, depending on what the Mercury were doing, because they were just really trying to poke at the Aces in a different way and say, you know what, here's double screens, we're moving side to side. And so you saw possessions where the Aces were able to switch off ball, were able to have clean switches on ball, but they weren't able to sustain the possessions. That's where I tipped the cap to the Mercury as far as having the mindset and saying, we're going to keep this pressure on you. And so you had possession, especially in that second quarter where the Aces were putting together 12, 14, 16 minutes of good defense. Breakdown happens on the third or fourth action. And so you saw that develop in the Sparks game where they came out with a great defensive mindset. And so I feel like they're in a better place as far as we feel good about our switches off ball. We're a little bit cleaner on ball to a degree. We're not as hectic as we were last year to where we're frantically trying to search. Like, we know what we want to do. We just have to get to it. And so some of the unders were nice. Some of the nuance they showed was nice. And so the bones is where you have to give grace and see, okay, this is the attempt. This is what they're trying to do. Do they get there every time? Not necessarily. But if they are going to be able to be cleaner on switches, if they're going to be more active off ball, they're going to be physical, they can build on that and say, okay, X, Y, Z is hurting us. We can lock in on that. As opposed to last year, where they were searching for a coverage, eventually had to land on switching to a degree, and then figure it out from there. So that's where the continuity piece ties in. I feel like the Aces are in a better place to start. Even if it's going to be up and down, they have a better option to start there. I think what's interesting is offensively, what they're trying to do to start this season. I felt like you kind of had an understanding. It was pretty clear they're trying to get the ball up the floor quicker, and they're trying to get into actions quicker, and they're trying to, you know, get it up early, get it up quick, get an early post up for Asia before the defense can get set. Get some staggers going, a lot of staggers, a lot of pin downs.
It's what they do,
like the right side, a lot on the right side of the floor, and just kind of flowing out of it. And so, okay, can we understand how teams are trying to guard us? Can we play out of the play? But I think you saw the impact of what Kennedy Carter can bring to the table as far as being able to have someone who can not just score, but get two drives and play out of a play. And especially if you have Kennedy and Jewel out there at the same time, it makes things pretty tough. And so it's just being clean defensively and the aggression and the patience from Jackie Young playmaking wise, I thought was pretty impressive. And I think Asia Wilson is Asia Wilson. So it's like, okay, we have the bones. We just have to like kind of flex our muscles and get used to what teams are trying to do against us.
Yeah. I think to that end, they're going to get an interesting week ahead for Las Vegas. They Connecticut Sun twice, which feisty group, but young group, but a feisty group nonetheless. And then it's the Atlanta Dream on Sunday. And I have more Dream thoughts a little bit later, so we'll save those. But like, I am fascinated to see what Aces Dream is going to look like on that front. And just quickly, since we already talked about the Aces, again, what a beatdown that was from the Phoenix Mercury in game one. Did not have the same amount of fun, we will say, against the Golden State Valkyries in their second game. So again, they were also dealing with that back-to-back to open the season. I'm intrigued by both of those teams, honestly. The Mercury, Alyssa Thomas just remains incredibly good. But this Valkyries group, Steve, starting out 2-0. Like, their defense is nasty, and they're making shots right now.
We'll tame there real quick. Let's talk about the Phoenix Mercury. I told you they would not be able to fool me again. And no. Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. You can't fool me three times. No. Can't do it. Kalia Copper said exactly what time they were on. And when I saw Nogic come off one screen, exactly one, with just a little bit of sauce, I was like, oh, okay. This is a little bit different.
They found someone else. Thomas would do it.
Like, Alyssa Thomas was really aggressive to start. I thought the Mercury had really good flow in the half court as far as getting from action to action and playing with purpose and going from side to side, disguising their sets. They wanted that one. And so when you have Nogic, who was able to kind of have this ability to play in pick and roll, who can be another person who sets inverted pick and roll for Alyssa Thomas, and not just the regular one, the one where Alyssa Thomas decides, no matter what you're doing, this is going to be a switch because you're coming to the paint with me. And we get a pop. Mm-hmm. We get after it. That's fantastic. Defensively, the Mercury are a very active group. They help them recover. They cough the paint. What was interesting is that specific back-to-back where you face the Golden State Valkyries who, it's Valhalla, but we are going to defend. And so all that side-to-side stuff is fantastic. But we're going to be physical. We're going to protect the paint, and you're not going to have a good time. And now that's the challenge for the Mercury. So we talk about matchups building up on each other. Okay, we found success doing this against one team. Another team said, absolutely not. You're not doing this. And now, like, Golden State made a lot of shots where they needed to. But, like, you tipped the cap to the Valkyries there. If Golden State is going to be able to double down on the defense they built last year, and have Janelle Salon unlocked, and have Gabby Williams unlocked, and have Veronica Burton and Kayla unlocked, is it going to be the most traditional offense that you expect? No. Are they going to go for it? Absolutely. And so is it going to be sustainable to a degree? Maybe not. But if their defense is going to produce at this type of level, they're going to have wiggle room offensively. They're going to be able to get in the flow and get some easy buckets, and they're going to be able to execute in half court and make some shots. So it's like, Golden State has the feel of, you know, and I asked this on the preview pod, who's going to swing the bat? Like, who's going to sprint first? Is Golden State going to be one of those teams that puts themselves in the top four early and says, you know what, we're just going to stay here for a little bit? And does that shift things a little bit? Like, that gets really interesting because that's not an easy team to play with. Like, Gabby Williams, the idea of it was, hey, Gabby, you can defend at a high level. We play defense. Would you like to just do stuff offensively? Because we've sat here every year and be like, hey, is Gabby Williams going to be unlocked this year? That's not a problem in Golden State. You have all the wiggle room to do whatever you'd like offensively.
Mm-hmm. I think quickly to that end, like watching the Valkyrie Storm game, it was kind of like, at least that first half, it's just like, so is Gabby going to be unlocked here? What are these touches looking like? Is she going to be knocking out shots, et cetera? The second game against Phoenix was like, oh yeah, this is the Gabby Williams experience that we were anticipating when she joins. In addition to, you know, bounce off your point, they have this defense, they have this level of versatility still, and they have this overall level of physicality that if you're not ready, if you are not ready to move the ball side to side, the openings that they have, is similar to how we talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder on the NBA side, to where, like, yes, you can create an opening against the Oklahoma City Thunder. It just closes quicker than just about any other team's defense in the league. So if you do not take the shot that is available or immediately catch and drive against the opening that is available, you are not going to have a good time, because all the off-ball stuff you want to do, like, they are getting into your body. They may top lock you, they may not, but you're going to feel them. They're going to disrupt the tempo of what you're trying to run. They may mix in some switching. They may have their bigs up to the level. You never know what their bigs are going to do. Quick shout out to Kia Stokes for her defensive start to the season, by the way. And then they just bought them, and they're able to play out a transition from there. And that's where the aggression from Gabby Williams, the aggression from Veronica Burton, the shot making for Janelle Salon Steve has pleased me greatly to start this season. I don't know how sustainable that level is, but we saw last season, the high release point, it really doesn't matter if you're here. If we do still have the three-point shooting from Janelle Salon, like, that wouldn't be a surprise to me. Again, not to this degree with the shots that she's taking. Her mixing in this volume of drives that we've seen through the first two games is where I'm like, hey, hold on. This is a different offensive player. If it's point shooting plus two-point mid-range shots, plus I am barreling my way to the basket and we can keep the machine going offensively on top of that. That helps raise the ceiling of this Valkyries offense. I don't really have questions about what their defense is going to look like. So I wanted to make sure we got the salute there with what the Valkyries were able to do. Stick to the one of the bigger matchups that happened on Saturday. We had the Indiana Fever taking on the Dallas Wings. You saw all the graphics, the last four number one overall draft picks, et cetera. Before the game, we got news. AC Phillips come off the bench. The Wings starting. Odyssey Sims, Arike Ogunbowale, who we didn't see in preseason play, and Paige Beckers all together. All three of them balled out. The Dallas Wings won the game, but there's still commentary around AC Phillips, 18 minutes, 3 points, et cetera, et cetera. We will get there. But the back and forth between these two games, because we saw them in preseason, but it was like, well, the Fever didn't have Aaliyah Boston. Ultimately, the Wings aren't playing their starters all 40, all yada, yada, yada. It was cool that this is how we started the season, just from an evaluation standpoint. Like, we're going to get a real look at what these rotations are going to be, what the attempts are going to be, et cetera. And for this to be a high-scoring regular season game, I don't think either coach was happy with what the defense looked like. But for me, it was largely a testament to, like, what these offenses were putting together. Like, you look at the Dallas Wings, they maintained their tempo, what we saw in preseason play and what we talked about on this very podcast. So salute to us. But they maintained that, and they were still able to go side to side. And the way that they were able to layer Paige Beckers in later in possessions intrigued the heck out of me. And you really felt that pop in the fourth quarter, to where we could start with her off the ball and let her make decisions from there and put your defense in a bind. On the Indiana Fever side, there's been a lot of conversation about, wait, why are you moving Caitlin Clark off the ball? That's odd. She's your best player. It's like, starting off the ball doesn't mean she's not going to touch it, but that's a Durant for another day. Watching all of these, like, Pacer-like starts on the left side of the floor, we pitch it to Aaliyah Boston across the court, gets a screen from Kelsey Mitchell, Caitlin's running into a catch, what do you want to do about it? The Wings did not have fun at all just trying to navigate what this is going to be. Just that progression in and of itself. And then Aaliyah Boston, what if I don't give the ball to Caitlin Clark and I just drive? Kelsey Mitchell, wait, what instead of the screen I just cut and Aaliyah Boston hits me there? Like, there's so much optionality within this Fever offense, in addition to Kelsey Mitchell can get a bucket when she wants. Aaliyah Boston can drive all over the place. Caitlin Clark can pull up from any, what the third quarter was for her in particular. So I just had a lot of fun with that basketball game. But to kind of broaden it out and to swing you the ball, Steve, what did you see from Fever Wings? What kind of stood out to you in that game? What are you excited about with these two teams moving forward?
Well, I mean, we'll just bounce off what you said. I think it's just the potential for both these teams and the pressure they can put on and their ability to maximize themselves offensively and what that means for these two specific teams, right? Are they defensive juggernauts? No. Or do we have questions about their defenses? Yes, probably. But at the same time, how are you guarding them? And what does that mean going forward? So pulling it back to what I said at the start, like, okay, how do teams try and defend the Wings? How do teams try and defend the Fever? If you're Dallas, this has been all about maximizing Paige Beckers. And Paige Beckers has answered the bell in every moment that we've seen so far. You talk about off-ball actions, you talk about on-ball actions, you talk about patience and control and command. There's been a different feel from Paige this year. And I think that's where it's like, you know what? I understand the thoughts. I understand the decisions, the discourse. You got Paige playing at a level that I don't know if we're really appreciating to a degree as far as there's not much you can do with me. And secondarily, you got Arike playing like Arike within the flow of what Dallas wants to do. I cannot emphasize how important that is. And shout out to Ozzie Sims. But okay, we got bigs who are versatile. We can play at a high level. We can get up and down the court. We can score. For Indiana, think about the journey they've been on as far as having Caitlin Clark and Kelsey Mitchell and Aaliyah Boston. And you felt good about all three of them to a degree, right? And the person you maybe didn't feel good about probably wasn't the one you expected to not feel good about, if you think about it. So if we have everyone operating to a high degree and we can maximize what we can do offensively, that's going to make us a different type of team. And so that's where you go back to the earlier question you asked me, like, I want to see how these teams grow because, okay, Indiana feels comfortable playing in the flow. Dallas feels comfortable playing in the flow. Who's going to try and bring them down in the mud? How do they deal with that? What do they execute going forward? But that's a good start. It's a good launching point for both these teams to where, okay, we've got our offense where we want it to be. And if we do this, a lot of teams have to deal with us a different way. So how do they look against different teams is kind of where my mind goes to.
No, I think that's fair. I think quickly to the guard portion with these two teams before we move to another one. I wanted to ask on the wings front, well, one, a salute and then a question. So a salute to echo you, Steve. A salute to Odyssey Sims, who had 20 points in the deals. Her drives, the timely three-point makes for her in this game, and she was part of like the full court pressure package against Caitlin Clark, in which, like, let me just bother your handle. Caitlin did not have a lot of fun dealing with Odyssey Sims. And then Isaiah James comes in. And if we're talking about points of emphasis and things like that, her drawing the amount of offensive fouls that she did defensively got a chuckle from me throughout this game. But just in general, you know, we're continuing for preseason play. Like, she has just continued to play well. If you want to go back to the unrivaled season when she would get some of the random minutes, she just looks more decisive and aggressive on both ends of the floor. Like, this just feels like a real development for Dallas. For her to be in the closing lineup in game one is a testament to how much she has grown over the past calendar year. So I wanted to give her a salute. The question that I had is like the question that a lot of people had going back to the very beginning of the game. AZ Fudd comes off the bench. Is that a big deal to you at all, or how did you absorb that decision / her debut?
It's not a big deal to me. I think it's the overall context to me, what I said when the draft happened. We believe in the talent that AZ Fudd can be, and it's insulated. Does that feel great with what Olivia Miles is putting together? Maybe not to some people, but okay, we are not asking AZ Fudd to do X, Y, and Z to make our team great. We are asking AZ Fudd to be as good as she is right now and develop what we think she can. And I think, okay, the pressure's off you to a degree. We got Paige operating like this. We got Arike operating like this. We got IC Sims to handle a lot of this. You come in, play defense, make these shots. And as you grow, you will grow into that role. And so I can understand the debate and the dispute as far as do you want that from a number one pick? Were there different options? I get it. But the holistic idea for the team is we want Paige to be this. We want to be this good. And AZ will grow into that. And so it's going to be something you have to judge over time. That's not a thing that I'm into. I'm not into the discourse and the debate. So you're going to give your opinion on this, or you just throw me a lob there?
No. Like, I'm in a similar boat as you. Like, I tweeted it as I saw the announcement, as I was waiting to get my credential and things to head in for Aces Mercury. I was like, I see how you land there, especially since Arike is now back in the fold. If you didn't want to start all three of those players together, they obviously want to be able to get Paige and Arike off the ball in Odyssey Sims because she can initiate and because she can drive. Allows them to do that. And you also, to your point, takes the pressure off of AZ in terms of creation. And you can also just kind of flow into different lineups where it's, all right, it's Paige and AZ and others. It's Arike and AZ and others. You have more of an opportunity. Jose Fernandez talked a little bit after the game, and there were some post-practice things that have come out since, you know, recording, et cetera. There's like, yeah, I want to make sure I do a better job, make sure that she is directly involved. So I would imagine we're going to see an uptick of like AZ coming off staggers and things moving forward. But I'm not super concerned, especially with this being literal game one of the season. And I think with as well as Odyssey Sims and Isaiah James played, if either one of them go backwards, and maybe not even them being bad, but if they're just not where they were against the Fever on Saturday, that inherently just opens up more minutes and opportunity for AZ. You know what I mean? Like, part of that was just these two are also playing incredibly well. So, like, I don't think it's a really big deal either.
I understand the pressures that come with being a number one pick. I understand the expectations that come with a number one pick being on your team. I understand other players in the draft class. But at the same time, let's let it happen. And if it's this, okay, then yeah, all right. It's not going so great. But let's give it an opportunity to see what it could be as opposed to just kind of stamping it. Like, I would avoid that as far as enjoying basketball. You're going to put yourself in a bind.
Yeah, and, like, most importantly, the Wings did win the game on Saturday. So, like, the volume could be a little bit, like, as a process person, yeah. I certainly understand still. But, like, let's do remember that part, that they did win the game on top of this. But, yeah.
Now I will say it probably is harder to swallow for some based on what Olivia Miles did in game one.
Yeah.
Her rookie campaign.
Yes, that's an unfortunate transition based on what we just said. But Olivia Miles did have 21 points, 8 assists, 2 steals, and 2 blocks in her debut for the Minnesota Lynx against the Atlanta Dream, a game that they almost won, if not for big shot from Tahina Pau-Pau, who closed out that game. I had some questions about how they're going to deal with the point guard minutes heading into the season. Tahina Pau-Pau closes. And then Angel Reese with a game-saving block. Was quite the defensive game for her overall, particularly in the second half of that game. But the Atlanta Dream able to eke out a road victory over the Minnesota Lynx. But I guess let's start, since we're talking about rookies, let's start with Olivia Miles. What popped for you during this game for her?
No, I'm swinging the ball to you. I'm just shocked you didn't talk about Alicia Gray's block that she had before the Angel Reese one at the end. Because that was the one. That was the one.
It was an interesting. Okay, to that point, and I guess I'll start with some dream thoughts then. We can flow to the links. It was an insane block from Alicia Gray. And in general, her second half, the way that she opened that third quarter, because it was a very quiet first half for the Atlanta Dream overall in that game. Mm-hmm. And for her, like, very jumper heavy. I will say one thing I nitpick very quickly. There was a possession in the first half. Atlanta had forced a turnover, and Alicia Gray's dribbled the ball up the floor. And she lost the ball. I don't know how she lost it, but she lost the ball temporarily. And that kind of forced her behind the three-point line. She ends up taking a transition three, and she misses it. And the commentator is like, well, yep, that's what the Atlanta Dream do. They prioritize threes over twos. I'm just like, not quite. She just lost the ball. I don't think she wanted a three there initially. Third quarter, she just puts her head down and gets downhill over and over and over and over and over again. So for her to turn it around to that degree, in addition to the big defensive stop, and then you get the Angel block to cap things off, very resilient win for the Atlanta Dream. I will say broadly, though, now swing it to you, Steve. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Dream half-court offense is going to always look like it did in the first half of that game against the Minnesota Lynx. There was just a level of shell shock, I think, to what the Lynx were doing defensively and just some weird decision-making from some of their best players for Atlanta's side. But boy, that was a very loud, ooh, this is what they have Bree Jones for. Because for all the talk about Carl Smesko coming in last year and we're going to bump up the three-point rate, and they did, the other part of that is like, we're going to take a bunch of threes and we're going to lead the W in post-ups by a very wide margin. And so in a game in which the threes weren't falling early and you didn't have Bree Jones or Brittany Griner for that matter, to just dump the ball for possessions and say, hey, can you just get this to the line? Can you just get on goal? It was loud. Their absences were loud in that first half. As Alicia Gray was trying to find it, Ryan Howard was trying to find it. Angel Reese was certainly aggressive, but she was also trying to find it. And so I am curious, even more curious now after that opener, like, can they establish their drives earlier than they did in this game against Minnesota? Because they're going to need it if they don't have, like, the post option to go to, as they did last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where, again, you just kind of have to give a team grace and understand the attempts as they try and evolve. And so they may not have Bree Jones to start, but okay, can we make up for some of that with pick and roll? Can we make up for some of that with drive and kick? Can we make up for some of that with defense? What do we look like going forward? And so does that put more of a Ryan Howard take us here? Alicia Gray take us here? The decisiveness from Tahina Pau-Pau? Like, how do they kind of solve that a little bit? I think Naz Hillman was really good. And like, as far as improving. So I think they've got a lot of pieces they want, just figuring out exactly how to put the pieces in. I'm intrigued to see how you felt about the Lynx, because this is a team a lot of people had some question marks about. A lot of people had ideas about. And like, you think Cheryl Reeve is not prepared to put a good basketball team on the court? Obviously, they didn't get the win. Phenomenal comeback from the Dream as far as getting back into that one, because it looked like very much a the Lynx are back, you should be afraid type game. But what was your feel on the Lynx version 2.7 or whatever they are right now.
Whichever version they're on right now. Steve, the level of vindication I felt watching the Minnesota Lynx up until they just stopped scoring for like five straight minutes in that third quarter, early fourth quarter. I was like, yeah, this is why people should not be sleeping on the Minnesota Lynx. You got shot making from Caleb McBride. You got shot making and playmaking from Courtney Williams. You got one heck of a basketball game from Olivia Miles, which I read the stats a little bit earlier, 21-8, two steals and two blocks for her. Now, did have three turnovers in that game. And it's less that she had three turnovers, but it felt like all three of them came in a row. And I was just like waiting for the camera pan to Cheryl Reeve with some of the turnovers that Olivia Miles had. So that's just going to be a fun game within the game for me when watching the Lynx this year. But like in terms of the concepts, it's what people should have expected if they watched them last season, especially when Fee went down after that blowout win against the Las Vegas Aces. We are going to go side to side. Our bigs are good screeners. We can also space the floor if necessary. And we can just dice you up and pick and roll if your coverages aren't tight. And having someone like Olivia Miles certainly helps on that front. But you saw some of the read from Courtney Williams as well. Like, we can just get to good stuff, and we play with a level of pace and tempo that we can generate good looks. Defensively was where I was more intrigued, because like this is a team that historically we're going to be physical off the ball, we're going to chew up space with switches, we're going to be super aggressive in terms of our nail help, et cetera, et cetera. And so like it did feel a little different structurally from Minnesota compared to last year, but like the ethos of what we want to take away was still largely there. Nia Coffey felt like she had, one, what a game for Nia Coffey, two, a lot of shot blocks for Nia Coffey, three, she was incredibly fed up the entire basketball game with how it was being called. And so like hearing the audio of that game, eventually gets a tech, I want to say, in the third quarter after she thought she was being thought it was an offensive foul, Angel Reese was sealing her, etc. So I just got a good laugh out of watching Nia Coffey in this game. The Emma Chakova drive, Steve, continue to pop, and we're gonna have some award thoughts a little bit later in the week, but just be ready for her to make an all rookie team is what I would have to say on that front. Unfortunately that she did end up fouling out, which kind of sets up the final possession of the game where Olivia Miles' ridiculous shovel pass for what should have been like a wide open layup, but the pass was bobbled. Age Reese able to recover. She gets the block. But no, like the Lynx are just going to put pressure on you both ends of the floor. People should not be surprised that the Lynx are going to be competitive this year. That's where I am at.
Fantastic. So what else do you want to talk about?
I love the Cody Rhodes of it all. Okay, so Steve, I want to swing the ball to you for a question, because among the undefeated teams through the opening weekend are the New York Liberty. And I know you were excited to see what this team looked like. They haven't had their full assortment of talent yet. That did not stop them from having a big win against the Connecticut Sun. A rude win over the Connecticut Sun. And then a more tightly contested contest against another team that you were excited about heading into the year, the Washington Mystics. So I kind of want to get your thoughts on, I guess, the Liberty overall and just the Liberty Mystics game. Like, what kind of popped for you in that one?
I mean, I think the thing about the Liberty right now is they are searching for things without all of their pieces. And so we're not going to have the answers on Liberty for a minute, in my opinion. Defensively, it's interesting. Very, like, a lot of things we're trying to do differently offensively as far as unlocking things, getting to different triggers. But Stewie has been game. And yes, we've seen a lot of action for Stewie. We've seen a lot of actions for Jonquel. And we've seen Marin Yohannes say, actually, do you remember how good I am offensively? Would you like to defend me? You're not having a good time. So I think the Liberty being able to stack offense, trying to figure out themselves defensively, that's going to be a journey. Now, it does help that the schedule is what it is for them to start the season as far as being able to do that. But they're going to have to compete on both ends of the floor, and they got to find the right rotations, right combinations. It's going to be a work in progress for them. When it comes to the Mystics, they are going to be an annoying team all year long. You can take your principles, your spacing, your love of three-point shooting, and, hey, Kiki Iriafin would like to seal anyone. Georgia Amore is looking to sauce things up. Lauren Best come off the bench. I'd like to get in the paint. And so we're going to be an active, physical, annoying team that can score points. And, like, Sonya Seatron has grown. And I think that's something people should keep an eye on. The blend of her off ball and on ball, the footwork that she has, the comfort she has as far as, you know what, am I going to purely try and cross you up off the bounce? No, but I can get to my spot. I can get off a screen and you have to deal with what I can do. I'm smooth with it. So, and we can defend and we will defend, and you're not going to have the most fun with us. So keep an eye on the Mystics. That gets really interesting. I think those are two teams where I'm like, I want to see what they put forward going forward based on the tape they've shown already. So That's probably what I would say there. But Stewie is it's hey. Different type of season that she's having right now.
Can I just say, on the Stewie front, obviously I want to see the healthy version of the New York Liberty, because I think they are going to be amongst the best teams in the WNBA this season with the collective size and talent that they have. I will say, from like a narrative slash conversation point, I'm glad that very early on we are just establishing like Stewie is just this. So we could just establish throughout the opening weekend, she is the best player. She is the most valuable player. Stewie is the one that makes this work. With all due respect to the other stars that are on this roster, I'm glad that we could just put the pin in this very early on that Stewie is the one.
Okay.
I'm glad that she's at this part. I just want to, let's just do that. Because we have multiple years where it's like, ooh, here's this Jonquel star. Is she the Liberty MVP candidate? Like, no, she's not. It's still Breonna Stewart. We can just salute Jonquel Jones without doing that. Last year, hey, Sabrina Ionescu, very truth? Much well, yeah, more in, you know, more comfortable inside the arc, the playmaking blend, etc. Is she the Liberty MVP candidate? No, it's still Stewie, but we should salute what Sabrina is doing. This year, Stewie has just come out on the mission. We can just, let's set this baseline now that it is Breonna Stewart. Let's do that. To the Mystics portion of the program, Steve. Not going to hang here too long because you already hit the major notes. You know how I feel about the three-point shooting. I just love the way that they space the floor, though, in light of this. The way that they set up their post touches for their bigs, it is just some of the best stuff in the league. And I think Sidney Johnson deserves a lot of credit. And just that staff in general deserves a lot of credit for setting those things up. Sonya Citron getting stronger is going to be one of the more under-discussed but important storylines of this W season, I think. And I think you touched on the drives is very important. Her ability to withstand contact and generate these deep paint touches, in addition to how the Mystics use her, is very exciting to me. And so I am with you. I am excited to watch the thing continue. Go ahead.
Now, hold on. The one difference you've seen is it's not just withstanding contact. It's initiating it a little bit. Last year, there was a lot of I can drive back in space. This year, it's like, okay, you're with me. I'm going to keep going. I'll hit you, and we're going to figure this out. So I think that's the growth point for me. Continue.
No, I think that part is fair. And so, like, that's where I'm excited to see how the Mystics continue to build this out. Because, like, they haven't had their full assortment of talent either. And so I think that's going to get interesting from a rotation standpoint as the season goes on. But I was very intrigued by what the start of the season was for them. So I'm glad you hit on them there. Can we talk Skyfire for a little bit? Is that an okay thing to do? What a fascinating basketball game that was. We got the official debut of like Skylar Diggins plus Mia Jackson plus Camila Cardoso all together.
We got enough time. Let's talk about the Chicago Sky. Yeah, you thought this was a rabbit. Yeah. It's Winnie the Pooh.
what a throwback reference from you. But I will say, on the Sky front, what a game for Skylar Diggins. The drives, the pull-up shooting, the playmaking, on top of that. Like, the pass placement and the pass timing for her was some of the best stuff I saw from the weekend, period. And like, you know, look at the assist numbers if you want. But watch her actual passes. That was really well done. And I think you got to see solidly, in terms of, you know, what you hit on a little bit earlier, teams trying to establish what they want to be on both ends of the floor. A lot more pick and roll for the Chicago Sky than we saw last year. Especially you talk about, like, how they want to flow out of actions. The way that they set up those pick and rolls, and, like, the way that the Camilla slips hit in this basketball game, very cool for the Chicago Sky. And I think zooming out with that game overall, it was very funny to see Chicago Sky pick and roll. Here's another Camilla Cardoso slip. What are you going to do about it? The Portland Fire, hey, what if we go ram screen into pick and roll 87 times? And let's see if Camilla or Elizabeth is ready to navigate a screen before having to deal with a pick and roll and the way that we want to space the floor, just structurally. I can't say it was my favorite game of the weekend, but it was certainly up there just in terms of what both teams were trying to do. But Skylar was fantastic. Very good Camilla Cardoso game. Still keeping an eye on some of the little things with her, but like, she was still able to impose her will in certain portions of that game. Gabriela Jaquez had herself a stretch. It really just had a solid game. Like, her drives really intrigued me, and some of the cutting as well. So it's fun stuff for Chicago.
I told you on Friday about Gabriela Hawkins. You didn't listen to me then. The Sky have talent. They compete. Fun mix, if you ask me. This is my type of carrying on. Skylar Diggins felt unlocked from the beginning, and I think brings a lot to the Sky team on both ends of the floor. So defensively, being able to navigate and pressure, and, you know, screens aren't a problem. Good on the weak side. It's just a reminder of what she brings to the table. And offensively, hey, I can run pick and roll. I could start a play. I can end a play. We can open up a side for me on the left side, and I can get a paint touch. And defense is like, we can run false action on the other side. It's fine. I'll get in the paint. Don't worry about it. I think Camilla Cardoso looks a lot better in pick and roll with Skylar Diggins as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You're going to feel the presence of that role a little bit more. I like the mix of Rikia's usage for the Sky. I didn't feel it in the preseason. Felt it in that game one as far as get out in transition, make some plays. Go out and attack. Get some pick and roll. Get some cuts. Get some pin downs. This is a really interesting group once everyone is fully back, because they got some dogs in that room. They're going to defend, and they're going to put pressure on the other end. J.C. Sheldon looked real comfortable as far as, all right, I know what my job is. I'm going to defend. If I'm open, I'm shooting. I might make some drive. Gabriela Jaquez, hey, was it a perfect world? Absolutely not. But if you look at the little things she does defensively and the ability to kind of grow on the bounce, like, this is a team that is going to be annoying. And so I wanted to salute the Sky. I mean, what do I have left? The Fire, one, salute to Portland. The Fire Pit, the love of the city show, the Fire being back is probably the most important thing to me. See how they adjust as the league works to adjust them. They're a work in progress. How do they handle teams trying to ball, deny, be physical, and switch? And I think the key is for them to, they're working to have the solves so we can be automatic. I'm just curious. Like, rest of them picking roll early in that game. I was like, this is the Chicago Sky. I'm not sure you have to do that, but we'll talk about that later. A lot of young teams that are good, like the Tempo, another team. Which side of the floor bounces out first for them? Like, I think the defense being as physical as it was really important. I think it gives them time to settle offensively. I think Marina Mabry and Brittany Sykes are figuring things out as far as where they can be pressure points. But, okay, can they get that within the flow? What does that open up for them? There's a lot of talent skill on that roster. So I salute the Tempo, but, okay, which side settles itself first? Anissa Morrow is a problem.
Yes.
I just want that to be said. The Seattle Storm, every single guard or wing on that roster is playing with a level of empowerment that is dangerous. And they are just looking to attack you. And it's insane. What else did I have in the notes? I think that was mostly it. But that's a fun start. That's a fun start.
There we go. I love it. Quickly to empty my notes, and then we are going to get out of here to the Portland Fire portion. The fact that the full court and the half court traps have translated from the preseason, they were able to force multiple 8-second violations against the Chicago Sky. What a fascinating group this is. In addition to just, again, enjoying their spacing principles offensively, the Carla Late drives were hit a little bit early. Luisa Geisler-Solder was very aggressive in this basketball game. Emily Inksler was all over the place. Like, they had some fun until they just could not score and then ultimately could not keep the Chicago Sky off the free throw line in that fourth quarter when that game went haywire. So wanted to make sure I salute them there. I am glad that you brought up Anissa Morrow. Like, one, I was kind of chuckling watching the Liberty Sun game. I was like, what did she do to Stewie for Stewie to be playing like this? Because this feels like a lot. But Anissa, and when you have the mix of drives and, like, the step backs that she can get to offensively, and again, she's always going to be trying to fly around the ball. I think that gets her in trouble sometimes defensively, but she does have a nose for it in terms of those weak side steals and things. She seems pretty primed for a big year to the Storm portion. I just need Jade Melvin. We need, like, I don't know what kind of mouth guard is needed to protect her from herself and how aggressively she plays. I want you to be careful because I really enjoy.
That's an Aussie. She get right back up.
She
you
did.
You never seen Jay Melbourne sure. flinch.
and you won't. And that's what you love about her. Her drives really pop for Seattle. Why are we talking about Seattle? Again, Flaget. Her off-ball usage and just the three-point shooting comfort that she has already has popped for me. Quick salute to Lexi Brown. Huge game against Connecticut on Sunday. Just let it fly all throughout that game. What was I about to say on the Seattle? Oh, that's the other thing I want to hit on the Seattle. Zaya Cook, hello. I think she is just a rotation player, Steve. I think if she's going to be play this level of competence defensively, you've talked about how good the empowered the guards are overall. So, again, not going to hang there too long. But I'm very impressed with what we've seen from Zaya Cook. Actually, I think I'll probably end it there. We are, you know, at the interest of time. But, like, what an opening weekend this was. We got a fun slate of games happening later tonight. We got Wings Dreams. That should be a big one. Talked about that one on the Friday preview. Like, hey, what are some of these style clashes going to be? But excited for this W season. Steve, thank you, as always. Thank you, dear listener and or watcher, for hanging with us for this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Plenty of playoff content going there. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel for our W content if you are more of the YouTube consumer of the podcast. You can follow me on socials at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.